Chapter 11. The Possessed. Gronf gave a little chuckle, one that surely did nothing to bolster Tiago's hopes.
"The orcs are fracturing," the archmage said.
"But that is not true,"
Tiago protested, a bit too vehemently, he realized, when Gronf scowled. No one ever wanted to look into one of Gronf Beanri's scowls.
"Hartusk is gathering his forces in Hartusk Keep."
"In Sundabar, you mean,"
Gronf quickly corrected, and in a tone that would brook no dissent. He had already made it quite clear to Tiago that he fully expected the powers of Lorwar to retake the blasted city before the next winter.
"The warlord gathers his forces, all of them, and Arothiter and his son are soon to return, by your own account,"
Tiago reiterated.
"The wizards of Silvery Moon will fight them to the end," Gromf replied. "Arothiter has already said that he wants no part of that powerful city."
"And we will bypass it,"
Tiago said, and he turned to Revel for some support.
"Everlund's defenses are surely more conventional and less rooted in the arcane arts," the wizard son of Matron Mother Zirazor Lauren agreed.
"Moving Hartusk farther from Dark Arrow Keep and from Sundabar," said Gromf with a chortle.
"It will be a quick and brutal assault," Tiago insisted. "We will cripple Everlund, though not likely topple her, and then turn fast to strengthen our gains."
"Our?"
"Hartusk's," Tiago quickly corrected. "With Everlund wounded, Silvery Moon will sue for peace."
"You have forgotten 3 dwarven citadels and the forces of the Glimmerwood," said Gromf.
He could not have been more wrong. The place that never left Tiago's thoughts was one of those dwarven citadels, Mithril Hall, where Drizdo Urden had taken refuge.
Felbar is fully sealed, Adbar in disarray by all accounts, and the folk of Mithril Hall have tried to break out twice and were put back in their filthy hole both times by the forces still arrayed about the 3 gates, said Tiago. "The elves are a nuisance and little more.
I would take Arothiter and his son over their lands and send the elves in full flight, those few who survived."
Gronf seemed to be mulling that proposal over, at least.
"Please, Archmage,"
Tiago pleaded.
"We can inflict more pain and use that to secure the gains for Warlord Hartusk. He and his giant allies will keep the kingdoms of Lorwar engaged for years to come. If we are taken from Hartusk's side now, with Everlund and Silvery Moon intact, the collapse will be swift for Hartusk, and our enemies, I fear, will fast turn their eyes to Menzo Berenzon and Cusor Lauren."
The anxious tremor in his voice could not be missed, he realized, and so he was betraying his true designs. But it could not be helped, and Tiago could not turn away, not with Drizdo Urden so near. Gromf began to chuckle again, but this time it seemed more with true amusement.
"Tarsak is upon us," he said, referring to the 4th month of 1485, which had just dawned. "You and your cohorts have until the dusk of Eliasis, 15 10 days, and then I will come for you and will hear no arguments."
"Matron Mother Quenthal will agree to this?" Revel dared to ask,
for Gromf had made it clear that he had returned to them this day under orders to bring the drow home.
"The drow of Menzo Berenzon, excluding the nobles of House Doerden, return to Menzo Berenzon with me this day,"
Gromf explained.
"The soldiers of Cusor Lauren are Matron Mother Xerath's to recall, should she so choose."
Revel nodded eagerly, Tiago noted, for his wizard friend had already told him that Matron Mother Xerath did not agree with Matron Mother Quenthal's desire to so abruptly end this war. There were gains to be made here, Xerath believed, and so, likely, Revel and his friends would have some Dark Elf support here, at least.
"Thank you, Archmage,"
Tiago said with a deep and respectful bow. Gromf looked at him one last time, chuckled again, and disappeared with a snap of his fingers.
"Are we truly alone?"
Tiago asked Revel, who was already casting a spell of divination. Ravel nodded.
15 10 days, said Tiago.
Mithril Hall will come forth within that time, surely, and Drizzt O'Erden will be mine.
Your thoughts of the rogue possess you like a canker worm, my friend, said Ravel. We were never here to hunt for Drizzt, as has been made clear to you repeatedly. We are House Doerden, deny not the connection.
To humiliate him, Ravel argued. To foul his name.
You speak like a priestess, said Tiago, like your sniveling sister, my wife. When I enter Menzo Berenzon with the head of Drizzt O'Erden, none will deny the glory, and all will give praise to Lolth that her betrayer has fallen.
Praise to Tiago, you mean?
Well earned,
Tiago replied, and he looked out the window of his makeshift palace in the ruins of Nesme and smiled wickedly. Dumuil sat on the edge of her bed in a candlelit room, staring across at Casidea. The sword was in its sheath, leaning against the wall, but it was in her head as well, calling to her.
Their games are not beyond you, little doe,
the sword whispered in her mind, for it knew that she was considering Tiago and Ravel and the others and their constant maneuvers to gain advantage. Or power. Tiago had taken her to gain power over her and over her father, and she knew, too, that was hardly the farthest Tiago would go to get what he wanted. Perhaps he would think it advantageous to murder Tosin, and if so, then surely her father was doomed. Or perhaps he would enslave her and use that to control Tosin, a noble of a rival house, to his advantage. She couldn't deny the possibility.
We will kill him,
the sentient sword began to whisper, but she blocked it out. That sword was as arrogant as any wizard or warrior Dumuil had ever known, other than perhaps Tiago himself, and it probably believed its ridiculous whispers. Dumuil knew well enough that if she battled Tiago Bay-Henry, he would cut her into little pieces with hardly an effort. And that could well happen, and could well happen very soon, before they returned to Menzo Berenzon. Even if not, the young woman had to rub her face nervously. For what life awaited her in the dark corners of the Drow city? She had only been there a short while, and that in a privileged position, treated as a noble of Barrison del Armgo even. But she had seen the sidelong glances, the hateful stares, the disgusted glances aimed her way. They called the matron mother of House Doerden, this elf named Dahlia, matron mother Darthir. Darthir. That was their word for the surface elves, and it was spoken with more contempt than Iblith, the drow word for living awful. In the minds of the dark elves, Dahlia, a surface elf, was filthier than garbage. Which was why matron mother Quenthal had elevated Dahlia to sit at the ruling council. By putting matron mother Darthir in command of House Doerden, by giving Dahlia a seat at the spider-shaped table, Quenthal Bay-Henry had thumbed her nose openly at Dumuil's great-aunt, Mes Barris Armgo, and at all her other rivals. Matron mother Quenthal had brazenly put forth the worst insult she could find to the sensibilities of the drow, daring them to defy her. When they could not, when they could offer little protest against the worst insult possible, a surface elf no less, Matron Mother Quenthal's hold on the city had grown much tighter. Half of Doomwheel's blood was made up of that same surface elf heritage, that same worst insult, and Doomwheel had been raised among the Darthir. Casidea called to her again, but Doomwheel ignored it. The sword couldn't really grab at her from this distance any longer. She had no thoughts of abandoning it, though, and figured it might be the only thing that kept her alive in the trials she was certain to face in short order. How had it come to this? How had she gone from being a princess of the Glimmerwood to being the plaything of a dark elf noble who served House Doerden beside her father and her? And Tyr Flynn, her brother, her murdered brother, why, how? Dumuil dropped her face into her hands and fought back sobs.
The door to her room banged open, and Tosin rushed into the room. She turned to him, expecting him to leap upon her, but he veered suddenly and went to the sword instead, swiftly drawing it from its scabbard. Then he came on, and the look on his face warned her that he was going to kill her. She fell back, but Tosin stopped short and flipped the sword to hand it forth to her, pommel down.
"Take it," he told her.
She paused.
"Take it!"
Dumwil grabbed up Kazideya, and the sword flooded her with calming thoughts.
"Little doe," Tosin said. "Oh, my little doe. Fear not and regret not, I pray you. What is done is behind us and cannot be undone. The road before us is one of danger, I agree, but also one of promise."
Dumwil wanted to shout out the remainder of what the drow had done to her, but she bit it back, and indeed, before she could formulate any other retort, she was already beginning to understand her father's reasoning.
"Your resolve is your only armor," Tosin explained. "Any doubts will be seen as weakness, or worse, as regret. And if you regret the past, if our hosts get any hint at all that you might revert to the foul ways of Darthir, your end will not be pleasant. And understand, my daughter, that in such an instance I will stand beside them."
He stared at her with hard eyes, then turned on his heel and left the room, leaving a dumbfounded Dumwil staring at her deadly sword. How had Tosin known her doubts? She hadn't spoken a word. The thread of thought dissipated in a vision of power and glory. Her parade as a returning hero to Menzo Berenzon, her private audience with the matron mother herself. Perhaps she would be the one to help mend the ties between the elven peoples, surface and drow. She was half-drow, and so they would accept her, and those whispers of Darthir would not land on her, but on the hopeless and helpless Dalia. No. She would be Little Doe, who used the cursed surface blood in her veins as a means to further aid her newfound family, as she had done in diverting the dwarves of Adbar into the Cold Vale to be slaughtered by Hartusk and the great old white death. She stared at the sword and smiled. She imagined Tyr Flynn's blood bubbling up around her hands, warm and sticky. It was not an unpleasant feeling. He sat cross-legged, feet up tight beneath him, his hands on his bent knees, palms upward. His back was straight and tall, stretched to its limits, but it was a posture achieved with an effortless grace. Brother Afafrenfir was well practiced in this art of meditation, and so his consciousness was far, far away, floating free in the clarity of nothingness. He was at rest, and he was at peace, absorbing mere existence, letting his life energy flow freely, letting the outside world in. He didn't guide the thoughts that began to come to him as he moved to deeper levels of universal consciousness. He didn't fight the flittering images, memories, and notions, didn't deny them. There was only truth here in this deep meditative trance. He felt again the movements of his body, techniques and attack routines far beyond his experience. Grandmaster Kane had taken him to that easeful place, had controlled his twists and strikes and blocks with a fluidity and precision Afafrenfir had never imagined possible. He knew that the great monks of the Order of the Yellow Rose were tremendous warriors, able to defeat fully armed and armored heroes with their bare hands, and no more armor than a simple woolen robe. But never had he imagined the speed and grace and anticipation he had known in that brief and ferocious battle. His life force had seemed a tangible thing to him then, like a line of glowing energy within him, one he could clearly visualize, one that, in the end, he could actually grab. As he had done under the tutelage of Grandmaster Kane, or rather, under the spell of the possessing spirit of the great man. Kane had borrowed from Afafrenfir's life energy, had focused it and shaped it like a missile, and that simple slap, just a tap, had sent the energy into the enemy, vibrating, growing, fusing with the monster's own life force and corrupting it to Afafrenfir's, to Kane's will.
He had killed a frost giant with a touch and a command. The mere thought of the power nearly sent Afafrenfir careening from his meditation, but he held his place, his stillness, and his nothingness. In this exercise, too, he was being aided by the spirit he had allowed to accompany him on this journey. In this meditation, perhaps the most personal of experiences, Afafrenfir knew that Cain was with him. For a moment, that repulsed him. His physical form shuddered, and he nearly broke the trance in sudden revulsion, trying only to get away. But he felt the calming influence of the ancient Grand Master of Flowers, the greatest man of his order, a monk who had transcended the physical to become a being of the higher planes. Even here, yes, he realized, even in his meditative trance, he was deeper into it than he had ever achieved before, because Cain was showing him how to receive, how to sink, how to let that which was in his heart be guided not at all by that which was in his muddled mind. And so he was at peace again, and he felt the movements in the quivering palm. He was training without moving, mentally creating muscle memory through simple but profound insight. The possibilities of the world, of this existence, seemed vaster and wider and more intriguing. Every day promised knowledge. Brother Afafrenfir was truly at peace. She spent most of her waking moments plotting, as was required of every matron mother, particularly the matron mother of Menzo Berenzon. Every strand of her web had to be precise and carefully nurtured and carefully watched. The insect uncaught would surely try to break those strands, and the fall of one strand could lead to catastrophe. She had pushed them all very hard. She had strengthened her alliances, bought off potential rivals, and then pressed hard with her demands on the ruling council, and particularly with the rejuvenation of House Doerden. She had made enemies and cowed them. That was the Drow way. But such actions required vigilance. Quenthel sat in her private chambers, surrounded by beautiful slaves who would not move unless she told them to move. Her thoughts turned inward, exploring the memories of Ivanel the Eternal that had been imparted to her by the Illithid Methil. From Ivanel, Quenthel learned to better spin that web. From Ivanel, Quenthel understood the length she could go to cow Mez Baris Armgo, among others, and the diligence she would need to prevent that one and her cohorts from finding their way around her spidery designs. She couldn't suppress her smile, so rare a sight that, when she let Ivanel's memories take her back to the time of troubles, when House Oblodra had used the chaos among the gods to press their advantage, their psionic powers had worked without interruption, while every other house in the city, most especially Bayenri, had been crippled by the absence of the Spider Queen. But Ivanel had played that time out beautifully, and so House Oblodra was no more. It would not be difficult for Quenthel to replicate Ivanel's successes. All she needed was care. All she needed to do was spin the web precisely and hold her guard over the precious strands of intrigue. And now Quenthel could succeed where Ivanel had failed. In fact, she had already done so. She had wreaked havoc on the Silver Marches with few Drow soldiers lost. She had dishonored the rogue Doerden by inciting the wrath of the folk of Lorwar against the mere mention of his name. The war had gone as planned. Was there now more that Matron Mother Quenthel might gain from this surface incursion? The air in front of her comfortable chair shimmered, signaling an arrival, and Quenthel sat up straighter and neatly crossed her hands on her lap. Gromph stepped out of his teleport spell to stand right in front of her. "You granted Tiago his permission?" Matron Mother Quenthel asked.
15 10 days, as we agreed," Quenthel nodded. "All of Menzo Berenzon's drow have been recalled as you commanded," Gromph said. "Only Tiago and the other nobles of House Doerden remain, along with the 200 that Matron Mother Xerath Zor-Lauren supplied for the effort.
whether they remain or not.
They will,
Matron Mother Quenthal interrupted. Gromph looked at her curiously and skeptically.
Xerath cannot resist, Quenthal explained. She knows her place as a satellite of House Bayenry. Her city survives at our suffrage alone. But in this war she has been granted a measure of independence, which she covets above all. She will not turn from the Silver Marches until she is sure there is no more to be gained.
There is no more to be gained now, said Gromph, not without risking the wrath of great surface nations. Will Cormyr come to the aid of Everlund if that city is pressed too greatly? Will Silvery Moon lash back with magical fury to overwhelm the Many Arrows legions? And how long will the stupid orcs keep the dwarves in their holes?
That is not our concern, Archmage. Cusor Lauren is not Menzo Berenzon. Should the powers of the world above seek vengeance beyond the borders of the Silver Marches?
But House Do'Urden is our concern, and her nobles remain.
Including two of Matron Mother Xerath's children, and descendants of House Barrison Delarmgo.
And the Bayenry.
No!
Gromph backed away a step, clearly taken aback, and the predictable reaction brought a wicked smile to the face of Matron Mother Quenthal. Tiago had been one of Quenthal's favorites, after all. Would she so readily disown him as a rogue?
Every drow from Menzo Berenzon who went to the Silver Marches marched under the banner of a single house, Quenthal explained. A rogue house, plotting independently through a scheme that was put in place by the advanced spy of House Do'Urden.
Drizzt, Gromph said.
Quenthal nodded.
And if Tiago confronts Drizzt? Gromph asked. You understand that is why he begged to remain.
Of course.
And if he gets his wish and finds Drizzt Do'Urden?
There are two possibilities.
Do tell.
If Tiago kills Drizzt, the peoples of the Silver Marches, the kingdoms of Lorwar, will be indebted to House Bayenry for ridding them of their scourge, will they not?
Gromph's incredulous scowl showed Quenthal that he did not agree.
If Drizzt is victorious, Quenthal pressed on, her voice rising with her sudden certainty, then we will claim great losses at the hands of a common enemy.
Gromph's incredulity faded then, replaced by a smile that soon became a chuckle.
Do not mock me, Archmage, Quenthal warned.
It will not work,
Gromph said bluntly. Quenthal sucked in her breath, verily trembling with anger that she would be so boldly challenged as she spun one of the strands of her web.
It was Tiago who flew about the Cold Vale on the Great Dragon, holding aloft the head of Dwarf King Brom, Gromph reminded. It was Tiago who took the head of King Firehelm of Sundabar, and took that too on his dragon parade.
Quenthal began to twitch, trying to reconcile these truths against her plans.
Duke Tiago, he called himself, Gromph went on. Duke Tiago of Nesme, and hundreds died under his months of tyranny. He is no hero to the people of Lorwar, Matron Mother. His name is more hated than that of Drizzt, I am sure.
His name,
Quenthal mused.
Tiago Bayenry, said Gromph.
Nay,
Quenthal corrected, and her sly grin returned.
Tiago Do'Urden.
Perhaps I should have brought him back, said Gromph.
No,
Quenthal replied, her mind spinning as she tried to adjust her thinking to where this might all lead.
What more can they do in the Silver Marches, in your estimation?
Everlund is vulnerable, Gromph admitted. Beyond that, I do not know. They have dragons, after all, and a host of frost giants.
Will they keep the dwarves in their holes?
Gromph shrugged.
Without the forces of Menzo Berenzon guarding the tunnels, and with the spring melt-on in full, and the fighting on the surface soon to resume, it is likely that the dwarves will find their way out. Whether they come forth or not to the aid of the other kingdoms of Lorwar, I cannot say. There is bitter animosity now, from all I can glean. The matron mother nodded and became more at ease.
15 10 days, she said, and we will have our answers. Let it play out.
There are many possible outcomes, Gromph warned.
There is chaos, you mean,
Quenthal corrected, speaking the word with reverence.
Chaos is joy, Gromph recited, one of the litanies of the Spider Queen. But should we not prepare to control the end of this chaotic time?
As our dear dead mother would do,
Quenthal asked sarcastically, and she tapped her forehead to remind him of the gift Methil had given her. Gromph conceded that with a nod.
Watch closely, but from afar, Quenthal ordered.
To guide the chaos?
Ultimately, said Matron Mother Quenthal, who sounded very much like her mother in that decisive moment.